Testing, testing. I'm not going to tweet or do Facebook, but I got a short story to share that Mary Veltri kindly provided and reminded me about. And at the end of my talk, I'd like to see if the young people in the audience or maybe some of the older people would like to comment on what they take from the story, because I think it speaks to some of what I'm going to talk about today. I asked Mary to come up with a reading for me, and she said the first thought that came to mind was the Zen parable about the man being chased by a tiger to the edge of the cliff. He's desperate to save his life and begins climbing down a vine. Two mice start gnawing at the vine. He looks down at the precipice beneath him with certainty that he will fall to his death. When he also notices strawberries growing on the vine, he plucks a perfectly ripe strawberry and eats it. Layers of meaning there. I've been thinking about it for a few days, but I'd be curious what you folks had to say. So give it some thought. You're about to fall to your death, and you see a strawberry, and you go, wow, I'm going to eat that. What's the message? Anyway, I'm not going to give you any too many hints here, but maybe some of my remarks will help. It's been an interesting week for me. I don't think anything's gone according to plan, and I've had a few setbacks, and it's brought to the forefront for me the benefit of my teachings that I've had over the years, and which I've tried to integrate into my life. This isn't an academic exercise for me, it's a way of life. And there's some techniques that I could share with you that I use, because there's no sort of magic bullet, all of a sudden everything's okay, no more suffering, no more problems, no more troubles or setbacks or whatever. They say that pain's inevitable, suffering's optional. Kind of agree with that. Anyway, before I get rambling about my Buddhist principles, I'll just give you a brief history of me. I started out as a depressed teenager. Well, I didn't start out, I became one. I had a pretty serious injury in my teenage years that took me out of my sporting life that I really thrived on. I went to university and started out in honor science. And when I found out that scientists can't say anything with a certainty, I was crushed. Heisenberg uncertainty principle, no black and white, nothing's clear. And I became so disillusioned, I dropped out of science, and I ended up floundering around for a bit and accidentally ended up in law school. Seriously, it was just a whim. A couple of my buddies wrote the aptitude test. I went with them, and I thought, oh, this is fun. I actually got accepted, so I went to law school. And that was perfect, because lawyers, nothing's black and white. Everything's shades of gray, everything's arguable. So that kind of suited the state of my life at the time. But when I graduated, I was dissatisfied. There was something missing in my life. I'd had some successes, some failures, some good things happen, some bad things happen. All kinds of events occurred, but I just felt there was something missing. And I went on a journey to the East, literally. And after vagabonding for about 3 years after school, I ended up in India and Nepal, and had the good fortune to come in contact with a Tibetan teacher named Lama Yeshe and his disciple Lama Zopa, a Nepalese monk. And I took a course in a monastery outside Kathmandu designed for Westerners to introduce them to Tibetan Buddhism. It was a very intense 30 days, and I got sort of drawn in. And part of my surrendering was to recognize I didn't have all the answers. There were some wise, kind people that could help me, and I kind of turned myself over to them and made a commitment to practice and follow the path of Tibetan Buddhism. That was back in 1977. And since then, I've had the good fortune to have teachings from other Tibetan masters, including the Dalai Lama, whose picture and nice saying is here for you to view later, and our own spiritual director for the local group here, Zaza Tolpu Rinpoche, is my current guru or teacher. And our group started back in 1982, and we're going strong. We'll talk maybe at the end, remind me about when we have meetings. I do a monthly talk, and I'm doing my monthly one for February tomorrow night at Waverly Library. If you haven't had enough of me today, the door's always open, and they're self-contained evenings too. What I found missing, I'm going to ramble a little bit because I haven't been well, and I'm not quite as focused as I'd like to be, but I'm not sure I like the word surrender. I like acceptance better. It's kind of accepting what's coming. There's a famous Zen patriarch several centuries ago, quote, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." And bring it on. Just kind of take it as it comes. Not passively, but kind of react harmoniously and intelligently and with mindfulness too. So I'm what I hope to leave you with at the end of my talk is maybe a brief overview of some recipes for implementing some of these practices. It's easy to say be patient, easy to say be kind, easy to say persevere, easy to say it'll pass. But we still have to work through a lot of things. And there's one thing I liked about Buddhism that I didn't get from the United Church when I was a boy, and I may have missed it. I'm not faulting the church, but I wanted to be a good person, but I needed some recipes to help me. And Buddhism provided me that, and partly through meditation, partly through what's called Lojong or thought transformation. So I'm kind of reprogramming myself to be a better, kinder person. And I was a very selfish, angry person when I went into the monastery and took the teachings. And I was kind of shocked at some of what I... When you start to look inside, you find stuff you don't particularly like. I was a little bit shocked. I was a lot more selfish than I thought I was, and I kind of awakened to that. And that was a difficult journey to think of others. I've been really sick this week. My granddaughter suffered a concussion in a school accident. There's all kinds of chaos swirling around me. And I've been trying to prepare my thoughts and remarks for today, so I had to put the teachings into practice. I had to be kind to myself, had to be patient with myself, had to persevere joyfully, I might add, and give myself over to others, because it isn't all about me and my suffering and how I'm feeling and whatever challenges I'm facing. This is your time, and that's kind of how I try to overcome my selfish thoughts that still come to the fore. Anyway, I did actually write some things down, so I'll try to follow a little bit of a script here. Ed told me I only had 2 hours. I told him I could do it in one. I'm kidding. Buddhists have a sense of humor. We're not all too serious. Okay, so we talked a little bit about my background. I didn't want Ed to mention I was a 30-year staff lawyer at Kinaway Legal Clinic, because I thought it was irrelevant. We kind of identify people with their jobs, not who they are, although the job might reflect who they are, but it may not always reflect their values. Like the Microsoft guys who don't want to develop weaponized stuff at Google, for example. But I saw a lot of suffering. I probably wouldn't have practiced law if I hadn't have had the opportunity to do it in a way to meaningfully help people. And 30 years of seeing marginalized, oppressed, poor people, boy, it was a real eye-opener. And some of them dealt with suffering a lot more courageously than I did, actually. So I learned a lot from my clients. And I think that was relevant to allowing me to practice my faith, which is Tibetan Buddhism. I think it's important to come at this surrender thought from two directions. One is, what are we giving up? Two, what are we going to replace it with? Not just, okay, I surrendered, what next? So I'm going to start with, what are we giving up? There's so many numbers in Buddhism. There's 10 non-virtues, there's 3 principal aspects of the path, there's 6 perfections, but there's also what are called the 8 worldly dharmas. And that is how we as adults, sentient beings, tend to focus our time. From our very early age, we develop a sense of I and you and separateness. And then the whole plot starts to unfold from there. And what I'm like to suggest we give up isn't attention to these eight worldly dharmas, but excessive, clinging, neurotic concern with them. And the eight worldly dharmas are very simple. They're yin and yang-y. Pleasure, pain. We want pleasure, we don't want pain. Gain and loss. We want to get stuff, not lose it, preserve it. We don't want to lose it or fail to even get it in the first place. We usually want a pat on the back, some praise. We don't like blame or criticism unless we're open-minded and it's constructive. And we want a good reputation. We want a, if not fame, at least a good reputation, not indifference or a bad reputation. And that's how we focus our time and our energy and our thoughts, which kind of can exclude other people. And if we cling to those things, I want this, I don't want that, I'm sad I lost it, oh, everything's awful, we're just forgetting we're suffering because of our mental attitude to events. And we're also failing to think about other people too. I'm going to transition into compassion and loving kindness here, because that's what we're going to replace our self-cherishing attitude with. And I'm not suggesting we not have regard to, you know, being comfortable, acquiring some things and enjoying them. But I call it excessive concern or neurotic concern with some of these things. I got to have it or I won't be happy. Sort of like Trump with his wall. I don't think he's ever going to be happy anyway. But if he doesn't get that wall, he's not going to be happy. So that's kind of an example there. And boy, I had a surgery and some medical setbacks in the summer. And everybody in the healthcare system is concerned about avoiding pain. Got a pain, take a pill right away. You watch the ads on TV. It's inconvenient to take a pill every 8 hours, so now they have a pill you only have to take every 24 hours. And I really just wanted to get more mobile and overcome a lot of physical restrictions, but it just sort of illustrated for me how consumed we are with avoiding pain, which is impossible. It's going to come, and how we react to it is whether we suffer or not. I'm not saying that there isn't some suffering associated with pain, like if my leg hurts, but how I react to that is what's important. Impermanence is also at the seat of some of our suffering too, because we acquire things and then they break down. We lose them. We lose our health. We lose our job. We may lose our family, our relationship, etc., etc. And that's partly because of impermanence. And impermanence doesn't have to be seen as it often is, a bad thing. The first noble truth the Buddha taught was there's suffering and it has a cause. That's the second noble truth. There's an end to suffering and that has a cause. Third and fourth noble truths. If things weren't impermanent, those changes wouldn't be possible. I wouldn't be able to transform how I think, how I relate to people around me, if things weren't impermanence. They allow some workability and some flexibility and some shaping of events, again, without that sort of neurotic control, but kind of a gentle moving forward and trying to create the causes and conditions to support our goals, whatever they may be. This can't just be an intellectual exercise, too. That's a start. The Tibetans talk about first an intellectual understanding, then a temporary experience of maybe letting go, surrendering, and then a realization. And a realization is defined on living each moment as if what you've realized is a truth. In other words, once you, as I think I'm getting closer to doing, once you've fully kind of accepted impermanence and change, it becomes part of who you are. It becomes your basically your mental and emotional makeup. So Oh, I'm sorry. I'm a little bit shaky today, so just bear with me. I was quite sick this week. And I mean, last week they were playing Beatles songs, and I'm more of a Rolling Stones guy. You can't always get what you want. Isn't that true? But it's really funny, one of my favorite sayings, and I get inspired by quotes. John Lennon said, "Life's what happens when you're busy making other plans." I thought that was kind of brilliant. And when my radio alarm went off at an ungodly hour after a night of insomnia this morning, who's playing but George Harrison playing Hare Krishna? So he was my favorite Beatle, too. So there's some karmic connection going on here. Okay. I'm a big fan of, I'm going to shift gears here for just a minute. I just wanted to add, as a former scientist, that the laws of impermanence is like a law of the universe. It's akin to the laws of physics, biology, chemistry. It isn't just something we've kind of made up. It's kind of the way things go. When my kids were young, I challenged them all individually and I gave them a weekend to think about it, to come up with telling me if they could find one thing in reality that didn't change. And they spent, all of them, 3 days, and nobody could come up with anything. One of them said, well, maybe space, which is kind of the emptiness between things that allows them to be separated, I guess. And in a sense, maybe that's not a bad answer. But the bottom line, and my kids learned at a very young age, everything changes. And you either dig in and resist, or you kind of bring it on and try to relate. And how to relate harmoniously and skillfully is one of the challenges. And there's techniques for that, too. Mindfulness is essential, I think, to work with any of these concepts. And in my tradition, mindfulness practice is done for a kind of a preliminary step to other techniques and other practices. It isn't just done for its own sake, but it's incredibly beneficial. The teaching about mindfulness talk about mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of external objects, all of which can be the object of a mindfulness practice. I mean, the old hippies used to look at burning lava lamps, and you can watch your mind. That's mindfulness of mind. You can watch your emotions. Usually we work with our breath. And there's physiological benefits. It helps with stress. It helps with heart disease. It helps kind of relax you and let go of the tensions of the day. But it also, mindfulness practice, if done consistently, even for a few minutes a day, allows a couple of things to happen. One is it opens up space in the mind. You're not just reacting. Everything kind of slows down. And you also see that all of the phenomenon and the ideas and the hopes and regrets and fears that we wrestle with are impermanent. They're projections of the mind. And the Buddhists talk about phenomenon arising, abiding, and ceasing. And our normal reaction when some phenomenon occurs, often our reaction is we put some label on it, good or bad. And then we think, oh, this is awful, or it's going to last forever, or it's never going to end, or whatever. But all those phenomena are just like clouds in the sky, these thoughts that we have. And we often jump on them, react to them, wrestle with them, judge ourselves for them. If you just chill and watch your breath, it's just so peaceful. But that isn't the end goal in my tradition. That practice is to open up your mind to create the opportunity to do what are called analytical meditations. So, for example, in the workshop I do monthly at the library, and I'll be doing one tomorrow night, we'll do the first 20 minutes, we'll do mindfulness of breath, mindfulness of breath. I'll give a short talk, and then the participants will do what's basically analyze and consider, reflect on the topic of the talk after they've already created that kind of space in the mind. And that allows us, the topics are designed to help us reprogram ourselves. And I take inspiration from the fact that the neuroscientists and psychologists are catching up. Mindfulness wasn't just discovered in the last 50 years. It's been around for about 2,500. And thought transformation, reprogramming our neural pathways and our attitudes and emotions, Buddhists have been doing that in other traditions too for centuries. But now it's becoming more mainstream, and I think that's good. The scientists can tell you what part of your brain lights up when you're being compassionate, but they can't explain what compassion is. And they can't explain exactly how you get there to develop that compassion. All they can do is say there's something lighting up on a screen, and that's good. So I don't think it's ever going to be so simple that they just electrically stimulate something or other in your head and you're all of a sudden you're compassionate. That has to come from analysis. It has to come from motivation to be a kinder person. It has to come from the determination to implement that, not just say, oh, I want to be kind. It's very difficult to be kind all the time, especially to bad people. And in our teachings, you will not fully awaken unless you have an attitude of equanimity for all sentient beings. All sentient beings. So I can't exclude you because I don't like you or because you're evil. We all have the seed of Buddhahood. We all have the potential to awaken. And every sentient being wants to be happy and free of suffering. We're all the same. There's a commonality there. And even if they're really evil, nasty people, they still have that seed of Buddhahood in them. It's easy to be patient with a nice person. It's easy to be kind to a gentle person. Very difficult to be patient and generous and kind to somebody that's just absolutely nasty. And I have to take a sip of water here. Really dehydrated here too. I meant to notice when I started, but I'm moving along here. Okay. Oh, I found a nice quote on my quote site yesterday from Lao Tzu. To the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. I thought that was awesome that the word surrender was in there. And if we're going to let go of our concern, excessive concern with our own comfort and well-being, I think it's helpful to replace it. And this actually becomes a practice when you're feeling sorry for yourself and oh, poor me, and this is hopeless, blah, blah, blah. So start thinking of others. That's a core Tibetan Buddhist teaching. If you're happy, that helps you link with other people's joy. If you're sad and sorrowful and suffering, that's a link to other people's suffering. Because we're all going through the same stuff. Nobody's any different. And I shouldn't necessarily have priority over anybody. Your happiness is important. And I had a really, really rough summer with my surgery, and I was in an awful lot of pain. I had a blood clot. I couldn't take the pain medication I liked because of the medication I was on for the blood clot, and I was really down a dark hole. And to make it worse, I was in the regional, which is not a fun place to be when you're sick. And in the middle of the night, I just remember I was in such despair and poor me and oh my gosh. And then I just had this moment where I thought, this is your life. This is your mandala. This is your universe. Accept it. Those are my teachings. And the weight just fell off of me. It was amazing. It was an epiphany. I've had a few of those. And they stuck with me. You have to kind of cultivate and nurture those experiences a little bit to keep the momentum going, but it was a groundbreaking event for me. Very, very, very powerful. And I'm kind of proud of myself because I was struggling. And boy, I'd never had pain like that. And I've had lots of pain and from different injuries in my life. And I was struggling this week too. I was so sick Wednesday night, I thought I was going to end up in the hospital. My granddaughter had a concussion, my daughter and her ex are in a bitter custody dispute that's just starting, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm never going to get prepared to talk to these poor folks that have to listen to me on Sunday. And I just turn my mind around to, this is for you. So instead of just poor me, oh gosh, this is awful, I'm suffering, I'm sharing. And God, of all people, my son, he said life is service. Sometimes he doesn't say much, and I'm not quite sure where he's at mentally and emotionally sometimes. He's in his 20s now, and he just came out with that one day when he was having a rough time, and he just said, life is service. And I thought, wow, I must have done something right here. No, I was pretty impressed. There are techniques in Buddhism, and I'll kick me if I'm getting on too long here, Ed, but I wanted to mention, just to let you know, this isn't all just talk. Those analytical meditations I was mentioning earlier, there are meditations you can do about the shortcomings of self-cherishing. There are meditations that you can do about the benefits of kindness for others. The Dalai Lama, who has an incredible sense of humor, he commented that being unselfish is the highest form of selfishness because it makes everybody happy, you included. And that's true. I mean, all of the books and all of the techniques, he says, kindness is my religion. And you can change your self-talk to gather momentum to become a person with that kind of attitude. It's kind of been a real shock for me because I was in existential despair in my teen years and went through a lot of angst and why am I here? What's the meaning of life? What am I supposed to do next? And you can kind of cut through all of that. It's interesting. I read a book by a Korean Zen master who's also a sword teacher. He's a sword master too. He was teaching in Paris. And one of the students asked him what the meaning of life was. And he said, that's the wrong question. This was another epiphany for me because I'd still and spending years wondering what the meaning of life was. He said, don't ask what's the meaning of life. Ask what is the correct thing to do, way to behave in the situation you're in. Do good, avoid evil, benefit all beings, and basically what should I be doing now that's in harmony with my circumstances? And boy, that was another little eye-opener for me too. I have different affirmations and practices I do every day. I think it's making me a kinder, gentler person. And that's my scientific experiment. People that criticize this kind of stuff, they say, oh, it's a waste of time, doesn't work, it's not scientific. I defy them and say, be your own scientist. Try some of this stuff, check it out, see if it works. That's the real experiment here. We don't need a bunch of scientists sitting in a room writing journals to tell us whether these things work or not, which is really kind of unfortunate. Some people become chronic skeptics. They think that's the way to get through life, skeptical about everything. They're afraid to believe in something. And one teacher said, turn doubt on itself. If you're always being skeptical and doubting, why don't you focus your doubt on your own doubt, and as my teacher would have said, check it out, check it out, check up, check up, check up. What's going on in your mind here? All right. I'll conclude with, and I want to make sure we had a minute or two for some questions. Probably haven't said half of what I planned to, but that's okay. We're introducing the tip of the iceberg here. One myth I'd like to bust is that karma isn't destiny. We can change direction. If we're selfish, evil people, we can become good, kind, gentle people. So our karma that people often talk about as if it means inevitability or destiny just isn't accurate. And I think that's important to know if you're trying to transform yourself. I better take this sip here because my mouth's getting really dry. Alan Watts talked about karma as if you're at the back of an ocean liner. You see the wake of the boat, you can tell what direction it's going. That's where my karma's taking me, but the mind is the engine. You can turn the boat. You can change the direction. So you can purify negative karma. We believe when we get sick, hopefully this isn't just a rationalization that you're purifying negative karma you have to get rid of. It's stored in your subtle consciousness and it's going to bring results. And there are purification practices to do to get rid of it. One of them is to just get sick. And that's the blessing of the guru, we say. Well, I sure didn't feel I was blessed on Wednesday night when I was sick, but I did think that way. The other thing we try to avoid is committing more or creating more negative karma. So there's no point purifying and ridding yourself of the toxic baggage that we carry from past acts that were not very wholesome. You've got to stop making more negative karma too. And I've actually got to the point with my practices, and I'm just a trench kind of guy, nothing special, where when I had a very difficult relationship with my son when he was going through a dark time, it was very, he was kind of out of control, and it was very hard to live with and handle, and I got to the point where I not only didn't want to fight back and pay him back and be nasty too, I actually started to worry about responding to his negativity in a way that wouldn't cause him to be more negative. So I loved him. I cared about him. I put him first while still trying to kind of shield my own being too, because it was a pretty rough time. So, I mean, that to me was another, not necessarily an instant epiphany, but an opportunity to realize I can stop just thinking about me first. And even in the heat of some battle or argument or nasty tirade I'm getting from somebody, I can think I don't want to cause further harm here. And I got to throw in a quip here, because I did study martial arts. I think it's very important everybody have some basic self-defense training. And I was often criticized for that. Even members of the Potala back in the 1980s when we started, they said, well, you're Buddhist. Why are you learning to fight? And actually, my teacher, Zaza Rinpoche, he studies martial arts too, so I kind of took heart from that. But I was bullied when I was a kid, and I don't want to be on my back in a schoolyard ever again with somebody pounding on me. I don't forget that kind of stuff. But I also wanted to be able to protect myself in a way that didn't hurt other people too. So if you develop some skill, you don't have to pump 30 bullets into some guy handing a pencil shaking at you in a streetcar. You can actually defend yourself with skill and do the least amount of harm possible. So I think that was important, that we don't see Buddhists as pacifists necessarily. And we also, boy, somebody, I don't know if she's here this week, asked me to mention Myanmar. What's going on over there? Holy moly. Many religions have been corrupted in support of tyranny and also used to justify violence totally irrationally. Whatever. I'm just appalled at what's going on over in former Burma, now Myanmar, to the Rohingyas. That's not Buddhism. And there's actually a lot of articles in mainstream Buddhist journals about that now, because everybody's horrified. I think every religion's had some kind of holy war or used their religion to justify what they're doing. But I took lay vows, and not killing was one of them. So anything, whatever's happening over there is appalling. And I can't explain it other than fear and greed lead to violence, and that's probably going to become more common as the world population explodes too. So I guess the takeaway here, there are things you can do to transform who you are and to relate differently. I'm going to conclude with a couple of my little... Chogyam Trungpa was a famous Buddhist master back in the 80s when there were virtually no books about Buddhism other than by academics. And he was one of the first ones, famous books about cutting through spiritual materialism was one of his famous ones. And he was interviewing a student one time who was going through hell and talking about her suffering with her. And he didn't, I know he didn't say this flippantly, but at the end of the interview, he said to her, "You can always cheer up." I thought, wow, that's true. So my little bedside index card that I read every morning, it says, be grateful, because I'm still alive, suffering or not. Be confident, because low self-esteem is a choice and it's a bad one. And be cheerful. And boy, has that ever changed my life. I mean, that's not exactly right out of Dhammapada or the Buddha's first lecture, but it is Buddhism in action, and that's what this is all about. So reminding myself of that commitment, and to work for all sentient beings' benefit too. That's the Bodhisattva path. The Bodhicitta goal is loving kindness, mind of loving kindness for all sentient beings, not just the ones you like. And that's kind of how I try to live my life. It got me through an awfully difficult time at Kinawea. Overworked, under-resourced, bunch of people fighting poverty. Poverty won for now, but we handed the torch, eh, Mary, to some new young people that are there and trying to help the incredibly... Oh, there's just so many people living on the fringe, poor and no future, no hope. Machines coming to take them, what jobs there are, and anyway. Okay, I'm going to just quit blathering here. Is it all right to entertain questions?
Wonderful.